Hey, I'm here today with Matan Griffel, former number one seller on Skillshare and now founder of 1 Month. It's great to have you here, Matan.
Thanks for having me, Ankur.
So let's start at the beginning. You were working at marketing at, an ad startup. Did you ever think you were going to be teaching online for a living?
No, not at all. Although I did want to be a teacher one day, like because my dad was a professor growing up. And so like I kind of always fantasized about, being like a sort of retired gray-haired professor wearing like a tweed jacket, like just like philosophizing in front of a room full of people. I thought that was like a fun lifestyle. But I never thought that I would actually have something that was worth talking about until I had already done something and retired.
Nice. So then how did it all start?
So I actually got familiarity with like some of the newer education companies through when I was doing marketing at the startup. I didn't actually know anything about marketing when I started. It was just like that was the role that was open and they liked me, so they put me into it. They're like, we trust that you're smart enough to learn this stuff. And I was like, okay, but where am I going to learn this? So that's when I first found out about General Assembly, which is still a co-working space at the time. They just had, a class or two once a week.
What year is this, just to give people a sense?
2011, like late 2010, early 2011. And so I started taking classes there, and I started taking classes on Skillshare. And they were all like, marketing for startups and like advertising 101 and that kind of stuff. I got to know a lot of the teachers there and made a lot of good friends and people who, I still talk to and are still with me. And so how it actually started was when I quit this startup, I wanted to start my own company, and I wanted to build something. Like I had this product idea, but I didn't know how to code. I didn't know any developers. Like I just wasn't in, that scene. And I kept going around trying to find developers to pitch them my idea and like just hope that they
I'm
would
sure they
build it
love
for me.
that.
They hear it all the time, right? Like, and now I'm on the other side of the table and I'm like, people who have ideas, like an idea is worthless, right? If you can't make it happen, then
I still can't convince my parents of that. I had this argument with my dad a few days ago where he's like, "Yeah, but businesses are all about the right idea." I was like, "No, it's execution." And
it's all execution. And my dad and my parents still call me with like app ideas, right? They're like, oh, I had this idea. Like, you got to build it. And I'm like, it probably exists
My
already.
dad's last idea was Facebook for people over the age of 50.
My
one, that's
dad.
Facebook. You're the only one still using it that much.
My dad's last idea was like to turn Facebook posts into a book, like to be able to pick posts and stuff and like then print out a physical book, which is like on face, it's a fine idea, but it already exists.
At
There's
least
like five
I'm
companies doing
glad
it.
they're on Facebook because all these old business ideas kind of were Facebook in different
That's
ways.
true. That is true. So I mean, the only kind of thing of it, I'm kind of glad I decided to do this was to learn how to code. And so I just gave myself like a very short amount of time. I actually went to San Francisco for a month and I just like booked a flight to go there after I quit my job. And I was like, I'm going to learn how to do this. And within a month, I actually had this prototype of this thing and I applied to Y Combinator with it, right?
Nice.
That was like my deadline, my sort of like learning hack that I developed, which is give yourself like a deadline for when this has to happen.
I mean.
And I didn't get in to Y Combinator, which is fair. It was a pretty shitty prototype. And we had no users. But when I came back to New York, that's when I first started like thinking about this path that I'd taken and all the resources that I found and the guides and which ones sucked and which ones were awesome. And people just kept asking, like, how did you learn how to code? Like, what did you do? What did you check out? What would you recommend for me? So I started teaching about
Nice.
that.
That makes a lot of sense. So how did you decide where to teach at first? Because you didn't have 1 month to begin with.
I didn't. I actually originally wrote three blog posts on my own blog about learning how to code, and then I had General Assembly share it on their blog, so they kind of like syndicated it because I wanted to get more coverage. I knew the General Assembly founders at the time, and they were cool guys. So they were like, sure, we'll post it on our blog as like a community member. And that actually, those blog posts got a lot of traffic for them. Nice. So the sort of the next obvious thing, because they were just starting to explore education, yep, was, you know, them asking like, can we turn this into a class?
Yep.
And the kind of the realization for me was that like, for an hour long class, I didn't have to really do too much in terms of teaching people how to code. Like, you're, yep, not going to actually teach someone to code in an hour.
Oh, the entire class is only an hour? Like, just,
yeah,
like one
first
off,
class.
One hour. Okay.
The first class was just 1 hour, but it was really just like the three blog posts that I had in person in slide form. Yep. I mean, the slides are still online. It's, yep, called How to Teach Yourself to Code. So it was more of like a meta thing, like not how to code, but like how to teach yourself, yep, and my story. And I just kind of, you know, had this mentality that like, I'm not coming as an expert. I'm coming as someone who had just done this, yep, like a month before. And I'm going to just talk to you about what worked for me, what didn't work for me, and what resources you should check out.
Yeah, but super helpful. So it's almost like you had an MVP for your course. It was literally,
yes,
a blog post.
Yeah.
Then it was a 1 hour offline class.
Yes.
What happened then?
Then one of my sort of mentors at the time, Jay Weintraub, who runs Leeds Con, he was actually a teacher that I had back in the day at General Assembly. It's like one of the first teachers who I just followed up with. He decided, he's like, you know, I'm going to introduce you after lunch one day. I'm going to introduce you to Noah Kagan over at AppSumo. And I think that what you can do is put together like a course version of this General Assembly class,
yep,
but online, and maybe make like a, you know, maybe make like a quick $5,000,
yep,
$10,000 or something like,
yeah,
that.
That's cool.
And for me, that was like, yeah, that sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Like a little bit of money, why not do it? And so I talked to them, and actually I ended up like, they kept asking me like, let's see the videos. I procrastinated until like the last minute,
yep,
and I recorded them all in 3 hours, just nonstop on,
yeah,
a Saturday at General Assembly, interestingly enough. And that ended up being the first version of 1 month Rails.
Nice.
Which became a Skillshare class.
Okay.
So when Skillshare started doing the online classes, they sort of pivoted. I had these videos, you know, they actually reached out about it, came together, and I guess in a way the rest is history. I mean,
yep. Let's back up to the AppSumo a little. How did the AppSumo deal end up going?
It didn't. That
oh,
was
it didn't
the
happen. So it was just the forcing factor that pushed everything along.
Exactly. But the reason why it didn't happen was they sort of, you know, I stalled on them for like 3 months. And then when I finally got it to them, they stalled on me.
Yeah.
And then sort of I'm like, okay, where is it at? Have you looked at these videos? And then, you know, like I heard back, like, we decided not to run with this class.
Yep.
We decided it's like maybe not right for us. And then the next day they had a big treehouse deal. Right, so I was like,
yeah,
I get it.
That makes sense. And I mean, to be fair, 3 months, like the ecosystem changes, right?
Totally. I would have done the same thing.
Yeah.
It was like a treehouse, like $3.99, like way more money. So I ended up with just these videos that kind of didn't do anything until I think it was like 3 months later when I started talking to Skillshare.
But
right. And I initially pitched a different class on how to build great presentations. Right?
Yeah, but it makes a lot of sense. Even within this class, what we tell people a lot is, you know, pick an aggressive deadline, just some kind of forcing factor so you get it done.
Yeah.
It's so easy to put stuff off forever.
Yeah.
The downside is launch days are terrible. Like today is officially the launch day for $1 Million Instructor. And there's so much stuff that's happened, you know, in the last 2 to 3 days, which is,
yes,
weird because 2 weeks ago we thought we were mostly done with the class.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Pick like a necessary launch date and like try to move it up a little bit so that you have a little.
Yeah, there's something interesting that happens to your brain when it recognizes something as an aggressive challenge where,
yes,
it just you know, kicks into overdrive and everything,
right,
just works really well.
Yeah. I mean, you can have so much time and really the bulk of the work ends up happening about that last,
yeah,
whatever day, 2 days where you realize like you have
no other choice.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think picking a deadline publicly, or I guess in your case, you had someone else that needed it, is,
right,
also like super important.
I mean, I do this. I still do this where like I would use teaching classes as a deadline for actually putting together materials.
Yeah. Oh,
like
an in-person class.
Yeah. Like I needed to put together this 29 Growth Hacking Wins ebook,
yeah,
that I've been thinking about for a while. And so I did that as my class in Istanbul when I just spoke, right? And I was doing it like in the last minute, in like the last 7 hours, but it's done now. So now I can use it as this thing that we can incentivize people, you know, for their email addresses.
Yeah, no, I think that forcing factor is so, so important.
Yep.
And I think the best part about online classes is it's a living product, so you can always go back and make it
totally better. Totally. And the first version of 1 month Rails was only honestly half of what I intended to cover.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, like the process of building a Rails app, I really only got people halfway.
Yep.
And I was like, all right, this is good enough for now, because I didn't expect it to be popular. Yeah. I thought like maybe 50 people would sign up.
Yeah.
Right. And then when the first class had 2,000 people sign up before it even started, I was like,
uh-oh.
Holy shit! I was having like anxiety attacks, thinking like people are gonna call me out as like a fraud.
Yeah.
Right? They're gonna think this class is like bullshit. And but part of me was also thinking like, well, why did I think this was okay for 50 people but not 2,000 people?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Right.
So I take it the 2,000 people ended up liking the class.
They fucking loved it.
Yeah.
I thought it was amazing. Like people just were begging for more.
Yeah.
It was amazing. And that's the biggest reason why I keep doing it. Right. Cause like,
yeah.
I mean, the money is nice, but it's like, it's a touching experience to hear.
I mean, I've talked about this before too. I just feel like teaching is such a human thing.
Yeah.
Anyone with a younger sibling knows that, right? Like, it's just something you do from when you're super little. You teach all the time. I think we don't have as many teachers as we should or could have, because at least until now, you know, the financial rewards have not been there. So there's been a pretty high opportunity cost if you had a lucrative career. It's interesting that's now changing. You know, now teachers can, you know, good teachers can make as much as, you know, pretty much any other career. But it's such a human thing that I get it.
It's
a good feeling to teach other people.
That's exactly right.
Cool.
Yeah.
So now you had, you know, people on Skillshare that really liked it. Was that when you knew this was your business? Like, was there a definitive moment when you're like, yes, this
is... No. I mean, all along the way, it was like me completely ignoring the most obvious opportunities for way too long. I didn't do it. I did a second class. We kind of A/B tested titles. It didn't do nearly as well. There were like maybe 600 students.
Yep.
I did a third class with the same title, but tested other stuff, and that did much better. So that class had 3,000 students.
What was the title at the time?
It was How to Teach Yourself to Code, :1 month Rails.
Oh, you had 1 month Rails since back then.
1 month Rails was in there. And a lot of it, I mean, people ask me often, like, why was this class so successful? I think it was just, you know, first of all, I think it was a lot of luck. Like, I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. But it was also it was the highest converting Skillshare class. So they ended up actually driving a lot of traffic to it, because for them, they needed users. And that was the best place, the cheapest way to get people. But I did a lot of research into what made successful classes on like Udemy and Skillshare. And there was like, you know, they all have like a very personal appeal by the teacher as a video on the homepage.
Yep.
They all had like a sales letter written out that was like very personal. They all had, or some of the most successful had certificates that you got when you finished the course. They had, you know, like there's a way that they talk about this stuff that I just kind of borrowed and put in to create this like 1 month Rails idea.
I think the other thing you did correctly, and I'm sure, you know, this was a conscious decision, is you told people what they would get after the class. There was a very clear outcome that I would achieve by completing this class, which seems so obvious right now when you look at the top selling courses. But back in the day, there were still people selling programming courses like programming books, like Chapter 2, Variables, Chapter 3, For Loops.
Yeah.
So I think that was another thing, you know, you did right. I think a lot of people now do that. But I'm sure that would have been a huge part of the student appeal.
Yeah, and I mean, I only did it because I remembered what it was like to not know the stuff, and that's really all that I cared about.
Yeah.
Was like, I just want to know what am I going to get out of this, and I just want to know that I have the end in sight, and I know how long it's going to take and where I'm going to be by the end.
Yep. So, I mean, these videos on Skillshare, I know a lot of people have told us how terrible their videos first looked. Were you one of them?
Yeah, like visually, audio-wise, all of the above. The audio was horrible.
Yeah.
People were...
Did you record it with one of these?
I recorded it with that.
Yeah.
People were saying that it sounded like I was in a tunnel the entire time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was the first upgrade that happened when I did the second recording of the class. I got this, like, I mean, you can't see the camera because you can't point it at itself. It's this HD webcam that I'm still using right now.
Right.
It's way better than even, like, the MacBook Pro webcam. And it costs, like, $70.
Yeah.
And I set up a little bit of like, lighting, right? And I got this, like, blue Yeti microphone for the second recording. So it was just really tiny things that made such a huge difference.
Yeah.
And when you're still early on, like, sure, you could spend tons of money to, like, make it really polished or whatever.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, there's like $50 you could spend and a little bit of knowledge to make it like good enough that people don't notice how shitty the quality is.
Yeah.
That's all they care about.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think $100 and you're like at the 90th percentile. To get to 100th percentile, it could cost thousands.
Yeah.
Which is probably not worth it until, you know, you've validated that your courses are going to sell in the millions.
Yeah. And I never wanted to do it that way because I always thought if I spent so much like money on production for these things, then I wouldn't want to re-record the class.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's a good point.
And that's, so you make yourself slower, you stop iterating.
Yeah.
Right.
Definitely.
So if you're kind of embarrassed by something when you first release it, then there's more incentive to make it better.
Yeah, totally. And again, going back to the fact that course is a living product, you know, it keeps getting better.
Yep.
So at this point, I mean, you had your Skillshare class. At what point did you realize, hey, this is a company, I need to own my audience, I want to put it on my own website?
Yeah.
What kind of led to that realization?
So after the third class, I decided to apply to Y Combinator again.
Yep.
Just because it had always been like a dream of mine to do YC, right? Like everyone wants to do it. And I got rejected, so that was like, you know, I had to try again. But this time I had something different, which was I had this, you know, I had proven that I could do stuff, like, that I could execute, which is like a big risk for a lot of startups, you know, that like it could be a great idea with a great market, but the people, you know, you just don't know about whether they can actually do it. And I proved that there was a market there of people who were willing to pay money and, you know, wanted more classes.
So you were making money. I mean, there's not a lot,
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there's some people that are making money applying to Y Combinator, especially now, but it still would probably place you, you know, in the top 5 or 10% of applications right away.
Absolutely. Yeah, they don't see too many money-making startups, especially ones that make like a good amount of money in like a short burst of time. And so when I got into that, that was kind of like, you know, realizing that there's this audience here, people who want more stuff, and sort of building up the team from there, right? And it was while we were there, we made the decision to move away from Skillshare and Udemy and build our own platform. Actually, I had already built the platform along the way because I was building features that Skillshare was missing that I needed for my class. So one of the things that I mentioned was like I promised people the certificate of completion when they finish the class.
Yeah.
Skillshare doesn't have that functionality,
yep.
At least didn't at the time. So when we got to 2,000 students, I didn't want to do all that by hand.
Yeah.
And so I built a Rails app to generate certificates for people. And that was the first version of like the learning management system that we have.
Yeah.
Eventually, you know, with Skillshare back in the day, they would point directly to YouTube videos that were private with like passwords.
Yeah.
And then the notes were actually like a text file that you had to upload that students would download separately.
Yeah.
It was such a clunky experience that I'd already had this Rails app. I decided I would just build these pages where I could embed the videos and then put the lesson notes below the videos.
Yeah.
Right. And so at a certain point, I sort of built this learning management system up piece by piece, like Frankensteined it. And then actually AppSumo came back to us later.
Yeah.
Right. Saying, oh, this class looks really successful. We changed our mind. We want to run it. And from then I was like, well, you know, I guess I could just pretty easily create like a way for people to register just through the site so that they don't have to sign up through Skillshare.
Yeah.
So the AppSumo, the second time around, was like the forcing function to allow registrations directly through the site.
Yeah.
And when I got accepted to Y Combinator, it was just when that functionality became available.
Yeah.
Right.
That's so smart. I mean, there's a lot of people, one of their biggest regrets was they spent too long at a marketplace and then were locked out without their users.
Yeah.
You almost without consciously thinking about that ended up going in that direction where you had full ownership of your students. And yeah. Now that you have, you know, a lot more classes, I'm sure you see the benefits of having done that early on. I think back when you did it, Skillshare probably was still giving you email addresses through PayPal.
They were, yeah. Through PayPal, but also they had an export email address.
Oh, really?
Feature.
Yeah, I don't think that's coming back anytime soon.
Definitely not. And it's so weird how like all these educational platforms move away from like things that are good for the teacher.
Yeah.
I think it's really unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, that's you know, pretty much the reason we were founded, just to be a platform for teachers rather than, you know, I guess they also have a challenge where they're ultimately a marketplace for two different sets of people. And I think they've all decided to focus on the student.
Yeah.
Which you know, is a conscious decision, and I'm sure it has its, you know, use case.
Well, I mean, when you've been the only player for so long, you kind of take for granted that like, oh, teachers have to work with us.
Yeah.
Right? And that's, I mean, it's the kind of thinking that ends up sort of like hurting the business in the long run, but it takes a while before that's obvious to people.
Yeah.
I think a lot of those platforms have done stuff like that, like,
yeah.
you know, increasing the percentage that they charge
yeah.
teachers and separating, you know, the connection between the teacher and the student, and just, you know, not really innovating or evolving the way that the actual, you know, courses are created and the information that you get as a teacher. So yeah, and so that sort of, that brought us to the point where we were, I mean, it was a tough decision when we stopped offering the class on Udemy. Because Udemy was still making like $3,000 a week for us,
yeah.
whereas our site was doing a fraction of that.
Yeah.
But we were getting, a lot of students started to get confused about
yeah.
like, what's the difference? Like, I see both of these sites, these classes on these different
yeah.
sites. You know, should I take one here? Should I take one there? We started having to support both like the,
yeah.
you know, the Q&A section there. And every time we made updates to videos, we'd
yeah,
have to then make sure it propagated everywhere.
And
it was a headache.
And I'd also guess Udemy probably messed with their price anchoring a little.
Yep, because they do a lot of the promotional stuff and you lose control of that.
Yeah.
And so it was a risky decision, but I guess I felt bold at the time.
Yeah.
So I went with it.
Yeah, and I'm sure at this point, you know, it's been completely validated.
Yeah.
The fact that, you know, you have your own independent portal with users registering themselves. Sure. And I'm sure at the time, just to give people context, can you talk us through how you price your course both in the beginning and, you know,
sure.
then what it's evolved to?
Yeah, so the Skillshare class started out as a $40 class that was actually discounted at $20.
Yep.
That was their pricing scheme, right?
Yep.
Where they said $20 for the first 100 signups, and they just kept increasing that number. So when we got to 100, they increased it to 200,
yep.
and then they increased it to 500. And it essentially it was like shady,
yeah.
right? But
yeah.
but all 2,000 students got it for $20,
right? Yeah.
Just wanted a sale. And I didn't agree with that per se, like, it ended up working out just fine,
yeah.
right? But I thought that $20 was like a little too low.
Yeah.
It's like anchoring the price of the course.
I guess from their perspective, your course in some ways is just lead gen for their
exactly.
long-term customer.
Exactly. So yeah, for them, they wanted to get as many leads as possible.
Yeah.
The lifetime value is way more for them
yeah.
than it is for me. But it ended up getting, you know, really mass distribution anyway. So like arguably it was fine.
Yeah.
And then, when we put it on our own site, we increased the price to $40.
Yep.
So we doubled it. That was kind of arbitrary.
Yeah.
But I think we were trying to do paid advertising,
yeah.
and at $20 definitely wasn't possible.
Yeah.
And then we ended up actually running a price test. So we decided to test out three price points, $49, $99, and $129. And we did it using Optimizely.
Yeah.
Right, but we did it in a way that everyone actually paid $49 on the back end,
yep.
but the price that people saw was different.
Yep.
If we figured that way,
no one
would
get super annoyed.
Exactly, no one would get pissed. Like, sure, you might feel a little misled that you thought you were paying $129, but you were actually paying
yep.
$49. But the fact that you're now saving $70, I thought was like, okay, well, at least, you know, they'd feel
was
better about
that. Was
that
explicitly communicated to people right after they're paid, or did they just notice $49 charge?
No, they just noticed it.
I've been there. It's not even like that. Just comes down to like just one more thing to build, and you
yeah,
want to just
exactly.
you know, get this experiment out there, and you
yeah.
know, no one gets hurt. So I've totally
yeah.
been there.
So I did it, and it was really interesting because it was like at $49, the conversion rate was 2.9%. At $99, it was 2.1%, and at $129, it was 1.1%. So a full 1%
so 99
drop.
Probably would maximize revenue.
Yeah, so 99 definitely maximized revenue, and it kind of indicated to us that like the $100 price point was like a big sort of like, you know, decision factor for people.
Yeah.
That, you know, more than $100, it's much harder for people to decide to do that. So that's why 1 month Rails ended up being $99 and the Stripe class or the HTML class. We've reached a point recently where we started doing higher price point classes.
Yep.
Actually, mostly as an experiment. You know, we kind of had this thought experiment internally, like, what if we charged $1,000 for a class?
Yeah.
How would that class be different
yeah.
than what we currently offer? And so it's like, you know, instead of thinking like, oh, we can never charge that, it was like, you know, well, we decided we'd have to put much more production into the class. We'd have to put, you know, much more bonus material, you know, code, like variations, designs, do like office hours and mentorship, and have it also be like a live event. You know, like we moved away from the class that everyone takes at the same time to the more evergreen thing where you can start whenever. But we decided that like $1,000, we have everyone started at the same time, and make it a little bit more exclusive, right? And say we're only going to accept like 50 people into the first class.
Yep.
So we did that with the growth hacking class, the iOS class, and the web security class.
Yep.
Where we ended up charging $899
yep.
or four payments of $250.
Would you meant like what would stop people from paying once and never paying again?
Nothing. Nothing would stop them from
Did
paying
you
that.
Find that to be effective though? Like do people follow through on that reasonably well?
I actually don't know off the top of my head what the cancellation
rate. A better way of putting it is, do you think the average payment from that plan is the same as the $899 plan, lower or higher?
I mean, so you make another $100, right? So in some sense, it offsets it. I think in this case, like even though there's probably a significant amount of people, maybe 10 or 20%, just a guess, I don't know, of people who never do finish, who never pay all of it, you want to get people's sort of momentum going, right? And at $250, it's a much lower.
So that's a good point. Those might have been leads you would have never had otherwise.
So you can't fully
compare it.
And I was thinking, you know, maybe the $900 are people who can afford to expense it, whereas the $250 are people who are taking it personally.
Yeah.
So if those are leads that we wouldn't have gotten otherwise, and then some of those people cancel, but some of them, you know, just kind of stick with it, then I don't know. We probably should have tested it, but we didn't. And it ended up being fine. I mean, also the good thing about it is recurring revenue, right? So moving away from just this like these spikes of payments. So now we could look forward over the next like 2 or 3 months and say, okay, we at least have this, you know, amount of revenue that we set aside.
I bet otherwise your investor updates with monthly revenue numbers are just all over the place. It's like, wow, we had an amazing month and now we're down 80% just because we haven't launched anything.
Exactly. Like, I mean, that's one of the more stressful parts about doing online education is, you know, our iOS class was extremely successful. And so that was the best month that we had ever had. And then the next month was way down because, you know, we didn't have a launch. So stability has always been a tough thing from a business perspective. We've actually ended up lowering the price. Partly, not because we didn't do well at $900, but partly because of, you know, when we thought about the vision of the company and the values that we had, approachability was important. You know, not being like this elitist educational, you know, like thing that people didn't have access to was important. Plus testing is important. And at the high price points, you don't have the same kind of, you don't have data, right? And so if we wanted to build something that's really gonna change the world, like we're gonna have to suck it up and maybe make a little less money, but so that we can continue to iterate on these courses. So we ended up lowering the prices to $299 and $499.
But are you still sticking to the same model of like that much like personal help, doing it live? Are those kind of experiments something you think you're gonna maintain moving forward?
Yeah, so right now we have $299 for the self-paced version and $499 for the one with mentorship. Partly that's been inspired by Pluralsight because that's the, you know, those are the two price points that they have. There's the mentorship option. I think, you know, it's a kind of another experiment we're running, and it's, you know, we're gonna have to look back a few months down the line and decide, is mentorship, is the human support aspect worth it? Are enough people doing it? And is it worth our time to think about as a business to just focus on that? Whereas, you know, should we just go to self-paced?
Yep. So the one thing I really like about this story is the fact that one, you're experimenting a lot with price, and two, you're not afraid to charge more. I see a lot of people terrified of charging more. And, you know, at least on the Fedora platform, most classes can sell for twice as much and, you know, massively increase the amount of money. I think the anecdote of how you went from 20 to 49 to 99 and at every step found that increasing the price actually worked out better for you.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they probably also produced more committed students, which a lot of people don't think about when thinking about pricing.
That was the surprising thing, was our completion rate went up when we increased the price, and the quality of questions that we were getting from students from a support perspective went way up.
Yeah.
We found way less people that were running into problems where we were spending hours helping them try to solve this problem. And so from like a resource perspective, given that we were like pretty constrained, you know, we have one support guy and we have like the team, it was much easier to handle.
Yeah.
Right. And that doesn't mean that we wouldn't want to lower it eventually as we figure out other ways to increase, you know, quality of support and completion rate. But it you know, is just really useful for us and really valuable. A lot of people did get pissed off when we increased price. So, you know, you kind of have to not be afraid of pissing people off, right? When we went from 49 to 99, people got really upset.
Yeah.
When we went from 99 to 899, people are just like, you know, what are you going to charge for the next one? $10,000? Or like, you know, or like, you know, just like, why is this class 10 times more valuable?
Yeah.
So you have to have an answer for that.
Yeah.
Right. And you also have to recognize you're probably going to alienate some of your earlier users.
Yeah. I'd also, you know, guess that $20 versus $100, fewer people ask for refunds at $100. At least that's.
Yes. So at $100, yes. At $8.99, probably not. We got more refunds at $8.99, just because if
people expected 10 times the value.
Because if you don't, well, it's less about that. A lot of people sign up for classes who don't actually start it because they're more optimistic about their own time.
Yep.
And so if you take a class that you don't start, you know, if it's $99 versus $900, like which are you more likely to go out of your way to ask for a refund for?
Yeah.
You know, it's like the $99 one, of course, that's like significant to you, right? Whereas with the $99 one, it's easy to forget about that, you know, or it's easy to decide, like, I'll take it later.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the first things that surprised me about the online education business. It makes a ton of sense now. But in a lot of ways, very frequently, you're selling exercise bikes. People intend to use them. People want to use them. They make they make resolutions. They, you know, promise to use them. But sometimes, you know, they still don't complete it. And very frequently, it doesn't mean your content is bad. That's just human nature.
Yeah. My co-founder and I were having like a debate about this earlier where, you know, and Chris is also a teacher. He was a big teacher at General Assembly. So he's been teaching a lot of classes. So we were arguing about what is people's intention coming into the class? Like, do people intend to finish a class when they started? Or do some people just sort of want access to this thing, want to sort of jump in, like more like casual learning, right? So he thought like there was some group of people that were more interested in casual learning. Whereas I thought people are probably just well-intentioned, like they all want to finish it. They just end up getting busy or like something gets in the way.
I think the pricing almost determines the kind of user you get too.
That is definitely true. Yes.
What I do like about the $899 class or whatever is the mentorship is almost like the personal trainer model. There's someone that's going to be a forcing factor. I think that is what's, you know, really cool about that model. The economics of it are something I, you know, I've never looked at up close. I have no idea how that, you know, specifically plays out.
It ends up being tough because I think what we've seen is that actually people prefer to pay less for not having mentorship.
Yeah.
But then they ended up being the ones who are frustrated if they run into problems, or they end up being the ones who give up faster.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's one of these, it's kind of like how, you know, Apple includes the Genius Bar for free for the first like 90 days.
Yeah.
Because if you run into a problem, like you might not opt into AppleCare, but if you run into a problem 30 days later, like you're going to want that support.
Yep.
And if the product doesn't offer that, you're going to be frustrated. Right. So we always have to think about the student experience.
Yeah.
And even if someone pays $99 for a class, if they sign up for this class and they're like, I can do it on my own, but then they run into a problem installing Rails and they need to talk to someone.
Yep.
If we're just like, sorry, like you're shit out of luck, then they're just going to be, you know, people who talk shit about the class.
Have you experimented with community and peer support? Like, does that work or is that overall like not sustainable?
It works, but it takes a long time to build up.
Okay.
Right. And you can't guarantee the kind of quick response time that a lot of people are expecting sometimes. It's something that we've provided as an option for people. We set up a forum for all of our classes using Discourse.
Yep.
And people are really awesome on there. Like, some people prefer that because they actually don't want to talk to someone live. They want to just post about it and get people's feedback. And it's becoming pretty active now.
Yeah. But it took a while to build up.
Yes, but a lot of people sort of they want a response within like 6 hours, right? And there's no way to guarantee that through a forum. But one of the ways, as we scale into content that we're not necessarily experts in, you know, one of the ways we're going to have to scale support is to figure out how do we get students to contribute and to become helpers. And I think that's an important part of education.
I think that again ties into wanting to price lower so you have more people and quicker to get a critical mass.
Because
the problem with 30 or 100 people classes is there's far fewer people there to answer a question. But I guess part of that is offset by everyone going through the same material at the same time.
Yes. If you can get them going through the same material, then you can build up a community. But the way I see it is, like, towards the end of a class or maybe even afterwards, we should be able to sort of either mandate, like, now you have to go back and you have to help 3 beginners, or now we actually can pay you to go back and help beginners. To, like, you know, you have now Rails skills. We pay you $30, $40 an hour, something that's not as much as a full-time developer, but like more significant than what they had been doing before to actually help cover some of the support costs.
That sounds super cool, but I can also see it being a logistical nightmare just to like manage that entire process.
Absolutely. So we've tried partnering with a few of like the expert platforms. Like, we partnered with AirPair to handle mentorship. And we're trying something out with Hackhands right now to do a lot of that logistical handling, because essentially that's what they've built out. And if that ends up being really effective, then that's something that we may build into our own platform eventually.
Well, that makes a ton of sense. So now let's just quickly talk a little bit about, you know, what you've done to grow these courses, because I know a lot of people, especially people that have made a similar transition from a marketplace to their own site. One of the downsides of that is you can now think about, you know, how you build your audience up yourself. So let's start kind of, you know, super open-ended. What channels have been, non-paid channels have been effective for you in kind of building an audience?
So, I mean, I have to say the whole Skillshare thing was super valuable, right? Because it helps when you're starting out to only have to focus on really small things that you're good at, right? So in the case, like, even starting a general assembly, they did the classroom, they did all the marketing for it. All I had to do was create the slides, right, and teach. Great. Skillshare was a little bit more complicated because I had to create the material, but I also had to produce it and put together and prepare the marketing material, like prepare the videos and stuff. But they got distribution by putting me on their homepage and by doing ads, right? So I ended up with a huge audience, and I think the long-term, the brand effects of that were very valuable. I mean, to this day, Rails, one of Rails is the most popular of any of our classes by a factor of like 5 or 10. Right. So it's kind of like, and it's also been around the longest. You know, we only released our second class in April of this year. Right. So because Rails has been being tough for like 2-3 years, there are people, you know, it's all these people who have been thinking for months, like, oh, I want to take this, you know, whatever. And then now today, for whatever reason, it's like the right time for them. So they do it. And it takes a while to build that up. So word of mouth and sort of the initial audience was super valuable.
I guess the other thing Rails has going for it is it hasn't really been dated that much. I know you updated the course with new content. But for instance, you know, a really popular iOS 7 course right now is virtually useless.
That is true. Well, I mean, there have been, I've re-recorded the Rails class 4 times. So there have certainly been moments where, like, you know, everything we already had is no longer relevant. And that's one of the tough things about teaching about, like, current technology. HTML is much better, right? Because it never changes. But so with education, I mean, especially if you have an interesting perspective and you have stuff you want to talk about, the most valuable thing you can do is just put free things out there. Right. And then you play that, you toe that line between free and paid content. So the things that I do and that I have been doing since the early days have been putting slides up on SlideShare. I mean, my slides at this point have had over 700,000 views. You know, the teach yourself to code, the growth hacking slides, I put the 29 growth hacking quick wins up there. Answering questions on Quora for people. You know,
does that still work? I remember that used to be a really good traffic source. I haven't experimented with it much. Have you looked into that lately?
I actually haven't done any answering on Quora in a while, so I'm not sure.
Yeah,
maybe.
I think that's a great example. I suddenly realized I stopped using Quora, and then I was like, are people still using it? And intuitively, I have no data on this. I just feel like Quora might not be as effective anymore.
It might not be. But nowadays, there's all these like sort of Reddit clones, like growthhackers.com or like inbound.
Vertical specific. Yeah. Bootstrappers.io. There's.
Yeah. Exactly. And so, you know, you have the ability to create content, whether it's free slides, answers to questions, people. Actually, we do use Quora to figure out what people are asking.
Okay. Yeah. That's pretty useful.
So for all these things, like, see, what are the top questions? Like, what are the things people want to know about Realms? Because it's been a few years, right? So I kind of don't know what people are asking anymore.
Yeah.
And so we create like blog posts around that. We create videos around that, and then use those and like seed them on, you know, like the Reddit kind of sites.
Yeah.
What are some other good sort of organic traffic drivers? I mean, talking at a lot of events, that's like not really an option, I think, for everyone, but if you can do it, like, why not?
Yep.
But I think a lot of what I do is just like, you know,
just producing a lot of high quality free content is essentially what it comes down to.
Yeah. And, you know, don't get too caught up about the high quality part because then people do less of it. Just like produce a lot of content basically. Yeah. Posting on Medium is actually one of the things that I'm doing a lot more of now.
Yeah.
Using that essentially as my blog.
Yeah.
But because it's on someone else's like platform, they distribute it, which is really nice.
I think the other thing I read about content is it's one of the few things where by increasing the quantity, you inadvertently increase the quality. From a lot of things, when you do more, the quality drops. But I think the more you write, the more you produce courses.
Yes.
Even now, like, you know, I'm still by no means an expert at producing video or even these interviews. The first interview I did, super bad. Now it's slowly getting a little bit better.
Yes.
And the more of it you do, the better you get. It's as simple.
That's a good point. Surgery too, isn't it one of those? Apparently surgeons who have done the same thing 500 or 1,000 times have like way less rates of like people coming back. I just read about this on Hacker News because there's a startup that's starting to rate surgeons, and I thought it was fascinating.
Yeah, I feel like in that case, surgery from a surgeon that's inexperienced should be a lot cheaper.
But you wouldn't want to
do that, right?
Exactly. And it starts to just build a snowball type of effect, right? Where this, you know, these blog posts that you've written a long time ago, maybe they get 10 visitors a day, but they keep doing that. And if you start sort of like cross-posting between these things, eventually you build up this body of work that really starts to sustain you moving forward.
Yep.
Right? That really starts to keep driving traffic to you. And it that takes a lot of work, unfortunately. Yeah. But
no, absolutely.
But then, you know, there's the paid channels too.
Yeah. Okay, great. Let's talk about paid channels.
Sure.
That's something that I know just anecdotally by like seeing my Facebook feed, I always see your ads. So
sure.
That's clearly something, you know, you guys have spent a while experimenting with.
Sure.
Why don't you start from, you know, the beginning? At what point did you realize that, hey, it makes sense, you know, we reached a point where I'm happy with the product, or maybe that's not necessary. You just want to start testing from the beginning. What point did you decide, you know, to invest in paid?
I mean, you start experimenting with paid like as early on as you want to see what's the CPA going to be initially, what's the cost per sign up, right? And it's very hard to be profitable with paid advertising from the beginning. Like people usually have to optimize them a lot and spend tens of thousands of dollars, right? In fact, we are still on and off profitable with paid advertising.
Yeah.
But retargeting is by far the most profitable form of paid advertising.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and retargeting is easy to do when you have content.
Yep.
Right, because people are coming to your site, you're cooking them, especially if you have your own videos, your own blog posts, and then you're just, you know, just advertising to those people or advertising to people who went to the page and maybe thought about signing up but didn't.
Yep.
Right, so with retargeting, we're able to like, you know, I mean, only pay like $20, $30 for someone who's going to then immediately turn around and pay us $100 or $900.
Yep.
Right, so. I mean, for almost everyone, retargeting is like a no-brainer.
Yeah. I guess the powerful thing with what we're selling here is there's no marginal cost to us.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like, you know, physical product that needs to be sent where there's a cost to the good itself. So
pretty
much the entire course price is your budget in a lot of ways.
Yes.
Especially if the lifetime value of a user is even a dollar more than, you know, what the cost is, which obviously will be.
Yeah, it's super high margin, right? Where all the cost goes into upfront and potentially support, depending on how much you want to do.
Yeah.
Right, and updating the content. But yeah, like you said, I mean, you essentially could pay up to the cost of the course, if not more, depending on what you think the lifetime value of a student is. If you have, and that's where actually having a big library of content is more useful, right? Because if you have two $99 classes and you can get 10% of people to take to from one to sign up for the other, then suddenly you're making $110 per person.
Yeah.
Right? And now you can pay $10 more.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely.
You can pay up to $109.
Cash flow is the only issue there, but otherwise, absolutely.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
Have you found a certain, so ultimately an ad generally points to a page. Have you found a certain kind of page to be more effective, like maybe a blog post or the course page directly or a specialized landing page just to collect an email address?
So with retargeting, we send people directly to the course page, in some cases even directly to the sign up. Like we found actually, we did a lot of discount retargeting where we tested out no discount, 10% and 25% off. And 25% off actually, it was so much lower CPA that actually made up for the percent discount that we were offering. And in that case, it made more sense to send people directly to the sign up page instead of the course landing page. We've stopped doing that because for the long run, we don't want to be known as like a discount brand. So even though it sort of hurts us in the short run, we started seeing people not sign up for classes because they were like waiting for a discount.
Yeah.
And they're just like, no, we can't have
it. I think that kind of might explain even why your 10% page wasn't working so well. The problem with Udemy and the like is they've lowered the value perception of online courses in general, and people are being trained in a lot of ways to wait for discounts. So it makes sense to untrain that behavior to whatever degree possible.
Definitely. But if in the beginning, if you need that to get by, like whatever, you can shift your brand. It's painful, but it's definitely possible over time.
So I guess with retargeting, you're essentially trying to capture people that saw it and like, oh, I'm going to buy it, but like kind of forget about it.
Exactly.
So in that case, they're willing to just act.
Exactly. And that's why a lot of people say they see my ads everywhere. Well, it's like, no, we don't do too much advertising. It's just people who have been to our site, right? And you've been to our site. But actually lately, we've been doing a lot around course pre-launches. So when we announce a course, we try to make it as big sort of a story as possible, and we'll collect email addresses leading up to a course launch. If you're doing paid advertising, especially from like Facebook, it's much easier to get an email address than it is to get them to sign up right away. So we've started optimizing for sending someone to like that launch page. How cheaply can we get an email address? And then how high can we get the conversion from the group of emails to actually buying the course? Like a month later.
Yep.
So it's more of a...
Do you email them in between to kind of keep them warm?
Yeah. So we actually have like a sales sort of build up process of like four educational emails and then two hard sells.
Yep.
And it's sort of extended over time. Ideally, it would be longer, like 3 months or something like that. Yeah. But
I think that's pretty good. I think that's what Nathan Berry talks about a lot. Like, you know, just building trust, building confidence, and then going for the sale.
Yeah, in this case, they're actually signing up for the class on the waiting list, so they know that there's going to be a sale. But if we were just collecting emails on like our blog, for example, then you probably want like a you know, longer relationship with someone before selling. And those have been actually like really effective and really profitable for paid advertising. Podcast ads too have been pretty interesting.
Interesting. Yeah, that's an alternative. I love these alternative channels that people, you know, don't really think about. We've recently seen people experiment with Reddit ads pretty successfully. Is that a direction you've gone in or thought about?
We've done a few Reddit ads, but it's been a little while. So
problem is there's usually not a lot of traffic. So you can probably, you know, spend $50 profitably, but that's all you can really do.
Yes. I mean, there's a few channels. You know, we haven't really done anything with AdWords that are probably worth looking at.
Yeah.
The Reddit stuff, you know, even like people have used StumbleUpon traffic. Yeah. Sometimes successfully. YouTube paid ads, I've actually heard, are very, very successful. And that's something we haven't really done yet, even though we do video content.
Yeah.
So there's I think, a lot of potential.
Have you looked into buying ads for your blog posts or using some kind of Outbrain or something along those lines where it's content ads?
So right now, we don't actually have a very like predictable path from blog post to like sign up.
Yep.
We're actually about to launch something we call the Learning Library. Should be by the end of the month. where it's actually a lot of free video content.
Yep.
Like 1 minute, learn about Rails, learn about HTML, like the whole thing, check out other resources, where the entire goal of that is to get someone's email address and then start an auto drip,
yep.
right? Then sell them a class later. But for right now, like the only thing we have is a call to action on a blog post is this like email sign up at the bottom once you scroll down.
Yeah.
And it has like such a low conversion rate because we haven't optimized it.
Yeah.
There's no incentive, there's nothing there. So it would essentially be like a waste of money right now.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But it's something that we, you know, will be doing and that we probably should be doing.
Yeah. No, it's so interesting. I think paid acquisition is one of the channels that it's really hard to make it work. But if you can make it work, just the scalability is amazing, right? You can just like put money to make money.
Yes, absolutely. And it takes a lot, exactly. Like it takes a lot to optimize. You know, I've heard people say it takes $30,000 to $50,000 to get a profitable, you know, AdWords campaign.
Wow. I did not know that. That's intimidating.
So we'll see.
Yeah. Cool. Last two questions. Let's start with what can we expect next from 1 month? Is there something we should look forward to? What's in the pipeline?
So we definitely have a lot of interesting classes in the pipeline, and we're starting to do a lot more like testing to see which content people want to see. So right now we have like 6 pre-launch landing pages on our homepage: a Python class, a JavaScript class, a UX class, a MBA class, like we're doing a 1 month MBA, an MVP class. We have like 20 classes people have asked for.
And are these, you have no intent to actually make them unless you've validated demand.
Exactly. And we're going to start actually moving forward doing free content around classes so we can build up an audience before we end up building the class in the first place. It's also a good way to build a relationship with a teacher.
Yeah.
Right. We're doing a lot of changes to the core, to the actual like learning platform. So we're going to start to modularize courses, which means that we're going to start to be able to create dynamically courses based on sections of other courses.
Okay.
So, you know, if someone really wants a specific kind of class that's maybe like, I want to learn how to do, just become a developer. Maybe it's like a week of the HTML class, a week of the Rails class, a week of about APIs and UX.
Yep.
Right? And sort of things that are more plug and play and interchangeable. Right, so getting rid of the whole idea of a linear course structure.
I guess then that does slightly change what you do while producing content. You can't talk specifically, welcome to 1 month HTML. You have to, you know,
It's a challenge, but I think it's a really interesting challenge for us to tackle. So we're doing a lot of interesting stuff from the tech side. Also like redesign, rebranding, a lot of fixes of things that are clunky in the product. And you know, hopefully making the support better.
That's cool. Yeah, looking forward to seeing all that live.
Sure.
Final question. What advice would you have for someone that has never really taught a course before, but is super excited to get started? Willing to do whatever it takes to be successful. What advice would you have for them?
I would say start small, right? Like, don't have this huge grand thing in mind from the beginning. You know, if you want to do a course, like don't start with a 1 month course, like start with a 1 hour thing, start teaching it in person. If you can, there's still tons of great, like you can do meetups. You can still, go to some, like there's a bunch of co-working spaces that let you just teach classes. If you're doing an online class, just get like just use your computer recorder and record like an hour or do webinars and stuff like that. Just really start getting feedback from people as quickly as possible. Maybe start it with blog posts. Right, and then it builds up over time. But like, try to simplify it for yourself. You know, don't try to do all of these things from the beginning at once, because I think if I had tried to do that, like I never would have gotten started.
Yep.
But the other thing I would also say is people have a fear of like labeling themselves as an expert in a thing. But no one who ever starts calling themselves an expert is an expert. You know, like the first time you say like, I'm an authority on this thing, like you're not. And only until people start to recognize you as an authority, that's when you actually are.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the ways I dealt with that initially was just saying like, I'm not like a Rails developer. I'm not like a pro at this stuff. I'm just a guy who did it myself. I have this story. I'm going to tell you about what worked for me. And you're going to take that, you know, with like however you want to take it.
And it's, that makes a lot of sense because there's no quicker way to actually build authority than by teaching it. So even if you don't start with the authority, you become the authority after doing it long enough. And I'm sure you become better too. I bet you're a much better Rails developer for having taught Rails.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think teaching is an amazing thing for people to do, whether you're trying to get a job or you're trying to build an authority or just build a company and like make money on the side. I would recommend that like almost everyone teach one class.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, why not? Make a little bit of money, make life easier for yourself.
Yeah.
And just like enjoy stuff a little more. Have money to spend on like vacations.
Absolutely.
Maybe it'll become something bigger.
Yeah, that's a great note to end at. Thanks so much for your time, Matan.
Thank you.
If anyone has any questions, you can leave them below the lecture, and I'll bug Matan to try and get back to you.
Fun.
All right, thanks, man.
All right, later.